Okay, I want to introduce for you our speaker tonight for Wisdom Fest, A.K. Kuravilla. I know is not a stranger to you. He's been an elder here for 3 years, and he and his wife Susan and their boys Jacob and John have been here for longer than that. But some of you may not know much else about A.K., and so I wanted to just share a little bit about him with you before he comes to speak to us later on this evening. A.K. works at GE Gas Turbines here in Greenville, and by way of training in his field, he's completed his doctoral work in engineering, and he worked at NASA for 9 years prior to coming to Greenville 5 years ago to work with GE. He describes his passion as equipping fellow believers to apply critical thinking to the application, communication, and defense of biblical truth. So he loves the kind of thing that he's doing tonight. This is right down his alley. Currently, AK is enrolled in an MDiv program, a Master of Divinity program, at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, their Charlotte campus. He drives up there to do his classes. He said, "If God allows it, at the present rate of one course each semester, I might be done in about 6 years." But we applaud you for doing it and encourage you along the way. His prayer is that his ministry would always be oriented towards the goal that Paul outlined for Timothy, and that is love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. So we're really happy to have AK teaching our time tonight on religious relativism. Look forward to what we will learn through that.
What I want to do is to anchor or use 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 through 15 as a springboard before we start looking at this. As we are studying through this, we realize in this particular case, Paul is writing to Timothy. He's telling him to stay on in Ephesus. He says, instruct certain men not to teach strange doctrines and so on. Then he goes on to instruct them about prayer, wide-ranging prayers for all people, all things, and so on. Then he goes on to the role of women in the church. Then he goes on to the qualifications for leadership in the church and all this. And why is he going into such a treatise? And if you go into verse 14, chapter 3, I'm sure we'll get there in the next few weeks, we find the reason. This is what Paul says. I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I'm delayed, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. The church of the living God as the pillar and support of the truth. What is this truth that Paul is talking about? If we look at verse 16, we have a nice capsule version of what the truth is. And by common confession, great is the mystery of godliness. He who was revealed in the flesh was vindicated in the spirit, beheld by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory. So what's the truth we're trying to proclaim? We're saying that God stepped down into space-time universe. He lived just like you and I. He was tempted in all points, yet he was without sin. He died a brutal death. He was crucified. He died, he rose again, as he himself prophesied. And then he was taken up in glory, and he's coming again. And one day we know he's coming where every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. That is the essence of the truth that we uphold. That's the essence of the truth that we support. And that is the essence of the truth that we proclaim. Now, if that is true, that also means that any other religious system is false. We cannot accept it. If what we proclaim is the truth, then anything that contradicts is, by its very definition, false, and we cannot proclaim it. And the question then comes back to us. How do we address religious pluralism? These different religions, different faiths, different beliefs, how do we deal with them? Are they really different? I mean, we have got our Ten Commandments, and if you want to throw in four spiritual laws, yeah, that's all right. You have four noble truths and eightfold paths in Buddhism. You have five creeds and five pillars in Islam. Take a number, 4 to 10. You got a few creeds and pillars, and all religions are basically the same. I mean, they're all involved in charity. They help, they love, and they promote peace and the like. So how do we do it? And for that, I just want for us to go back to the basics here just a little bit so that we can deal with this rather effectively. And therefore, the title of our message this evening is Pathway to God, Many or One. And the first thing I want to emphasize is a working definition of truth. Truth, point 1.1 there, truth is the accurate perception or description of reality. It's the accurate perception or description of reality. It's just a working definition. It's not a philosophically tight and rigorous definition, but for working purposes, it's the accurate perception or description of reality. Now, if we dwell on that, we recognize that what it means is I can perceive and describe what is real. Now, what I perceive and describe may not be accurate. It may not even be exhaustive. It may just be adequate. It can be any of those things, but I can perceive something and describe something. For example, if reality is, or the truth is, that I am a man, then if you perceive me to be a man and describe me to be a man, then you have the truth. On the other hand, if you perceive me to be a tree and start climbing on me, as my kids used to do when they were much younger, then obviously you don't have the truth because you haven't perceived right and therefore you cannot describe right. And you go one step further and decide to chop me up for firewood, then you really have the truth all out of whack. So truth is the accurate perception and description of reality. It's the accurate perception and description of reality. Now, if it is actually the good, accurate perception of reality, then certain conclusions necessarily follow. The first one I want to point out, point 1.2, is that truth is independent of personal likes, dislikes, and opinions. Truth is independent of personal preferences. It doesn't matter what I think or feel. Truth is independent of my personal preferences. I can think that I'm Superman, but that doesn't change reality. I can think that I'm a butterfly dreaming that I'm a man. That doesn't change reality. It's like the student in a philosophy class who kind of raised his hands and said, "Sir, I don't think I exist." The professor kind of lowered his glasses. He looked and said, "And who may I say is asking that question?" Sometimes you cannot escape some basic facts. You cannot escape what is true and real. So truth is independent of personal preferences and likes and opinions. Okay? Now, the second point that I want to make is that truth does not change with time. It is absolute, not relative. Truth does not change with time. It's absolute, not relative. Now, you might say, well, truth does change with time. When we got married 17 years ago, I weighed in at 132 pounds. Since then, the calories in the air in the places we have lived has added 25 pounds to my frame. Now, you say, has the truth changed? Well, my weight has changed. If I describe the time frame accurately, then the truth has not changed. So back in 1987, I was 132 pounds. That is true. Today, I'm 157, and that is true. Truth still remains. It doesn't change with time. Okay? Therefore, truth is absolute and not relative. So it's important to recognize that. Truth is independent of personal preferences. Truth does not change with time. It is absolute, not relative. Also, truth does not change with people and perceptions. Truth does not change with people and perceptions. Well, you might say, If we take a poll here, a few people might say, well, the temperature is just perfect. Another group might say, it's too hot. And another group will say, it's too cold. And you might say, well, truth is subjective. The fact of the matter is, the temperature, whatever it is, let's say it's 70 degrees Fahrenheit, is the same. What you're feeling is subjective, but the truth, the reality, remains the same. Truth does not change with people and perceptions. The fact that I choose to be a card-carrying member of the Flat Earth Society doesn't make the Earth flat. Yes? So it is not necessarily dependent on my feelings and my perceptions. Truth is absolutely objective and not subjective. Okay? So if truth is independent of personal preferences, if truth does not change with time, and truth does not change with people, then we come up with a very, very important conclusion. And that is, if you ignore truth, you invite trouble. If you ignore truth, you invite trouble. Now, this is true of every realm of life. Let's take the physical realm. I can choose to ignore that there is such a thing as the law of gravity and decide to kind of fly away from the top of, let's say, the tallest building in downtown Greenville. And the consequences are not particularly inviting, are they? I can choose to ignore in the physical realm that the law of gravity exists, but I quickly come to terms with the fact that the law of gravity does exist, and I will feel the pain very soon. So if I ignore the truth of the law of gravity, I'm inviting trouble for myself. Now, that's true not only in the physical realm, it's also true in the realm of relationships. If the truth is that marriages flourish when a husband loves his wife as Christ loves her, sacrificially and unconditionally, regardless of whether she's lovable or not, then you ignore that truth, you're clearly inviting trouble. Likewise, if the marriage will flourish when the husband plays that role, and if the wife is submissive to the leadership of the husband, and submissive to his leadership even when he is a worthless leader, and wins him over with her gentle and quiet spirit, the marriage will flourish. If that's the design intent that God has for marriage, you ignore that truth, you invite trouble. Now, I'm not hanging this over as a threat for anybody, don't get me wrong. The fact is that if you ignore truth, it's like banging your head against a concrete wall and expecting the concrete wall to kind of take the shape of your head. It just doesn't happen. When you bang your head against the concrete wall, you will break your head. Now, this is not rocket science, is it? If you ignore truth, you invite trouble. And I think we need to recognize that very clearly. I mean, it's got to be etched in our system. It is not just a matter of looking at that as an idea or a concept or anything like that. God, in his infinite mercy and grace, has given us in his word how we ought to live. He has given us principles. I mean, his word is active and powerful. It speaks to us. It changes us. It transforms us. And if we don't respond to the truth of God's word, we are inviting trouble. We are inviting trouble. And that happens in the realm of relationships. It also happens in the realm of salvation, in the spiritual realm. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. If that is true, and you ignore that truth, then you quickly are inviting trouble. Because you're not going to get the Father and you're straight hellward bound if what Jesus said is true. Okay? So the issue, of course, then becomes, is that true? The point that I want to drive home there is that truth does not adapt to me. I have to adapt to truth. And the point there is reality does not adapt to me. I have to adapt myself to reality. And that is a very basic fact that we experience in life, and we need to continually be aware of that. That if we ignore truth, we invite trouble. That truth and reality does not adapt to me and my personal preferences, that I have to adapt myself to the reality if I want to continue to move on without trouble. Okay? Good. Now, the next point I want to make is truth is the basis for freedom and tolerance. Truth is the basis for freedom and tolerance. Now, what do I mean by that? If you think of a fish is really free only within the confines of water. If the fish decides to rebel and say, I'm going to jump out of this water, that's the end of the fish's life. A fish is truly free only within the confines of water. Now, how does that translate to your life and mine? Let's say you were in this room here and you knew exactly where the exit doors were. And there's a fire or something, and there's an announcement, you need to exit this place. If you know the truth as to where the exit doors are, you could move around rather freely and then exit the doors when the announcement is made. Now, suppose you don't know the truth. Suppose you don't know the truth. You don't know where the exit doors are. And then what happens is we have suddenly lost our freedom, and when an announcement is made to exit this hall, there's going to be total confusion and chaos. So take it one step further. If we live in a society which says there is no such thing as truth, then obviously anything goes, doesn't it? Anything goes. And so if anything goes, and if there is no such thing as a right and a wrong, then obviously the net result is chaos. And to address chaos, you've got to come up with all sorts of legislation, and in extreme cases, you've got to have repression and force to be able to bring some control in this situation of total chaos. So the loss of truth has very significant implications. When truth is lost, we really lose our freedom. Now, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Now, he was not talking of our moral realm of truth. He was talking in terms of, look, if you trust Christ, you are no more under bondage. And your bondage is gone and you are truly free to serve him. So that's when he said, that's what he meant by saying, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. But the fundamental principle is this. The moment truth is thrown out of the window, we lose our freedoms. Now, in our society, it may not be anything very drastic that we can observe, but eventually it has got to be that way, because if there is no truth, no standard by which we can measure anything, then anything goes. The net result is total confusion and chaos and anarchy. And to be able to control that, there's got to be either excessive amount of force or repression or excessive amount of legislation and a follow-up of all that. All right. So truth is the basis for freedom. The truth is also the basis of tolerance. For example, because it is true that you are created in the image of God as I am, I have to pay attention to what you say. Because I know I am finite and that I don't know everything, I have to have a sense of humility when I deal with you. I have to have a sense of humility and listen to what you have to say and pay attention to the ideas that you have to present. Because I know that what I know is what God has shown me, I should continue to have a sense of humility in dealing with others who have been created in the image of God. So the fact or the truth of the fact or the truth that you're created in the image of God is what allows us to be tolerant of people. Now, when you take that out, tolerance is lost. So once tolerance is lost, everybody's got ideas. There is no standard by which you can measure and say an idea is good, mediocre, or bad. So the net result is you have all kinds of ideas which are either politically correct or incorrect. It's not a matter of whether they're right or wrong because you've lost the standard. It's either politically right or politically wrong. So the implications are enormous, that when truth goes out of the window, the basis for freedom and the basis for tolerance also goes out. And you see that being played out in our social setup. So truth is the accurate perception or description of reality. Truth is independent of personal preferences. Truth does not change with time. Truth does not change with people. You ignore truth, you invite trouble. Truth does not adapt to me, or reality does not adapt to me. I have to adapt myself to reality, and truth is the basis for freedom and tolerance. Religions, are they really exclusive or inclusive? All truth claims are exclusive. All truth claims are exclusive. If I say that I am a man, that implies that I am a man and not a woman. It implies that I am a man and not an elephant. I could be a son, I could be a father, but I am a man and not anything other than a man. So the claim of truth is exclusive. It excludes everything that is false. Okay? Truth is exclusive. And truth, by definition, excludes everything else. So Jesus made a very reasonable claim. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. It's a very reasonable claim, because if it is true, what he says is, none of these other characters can get you to God. And that makes sense, because truth excludes what is false. Truth is exclusive. And then you might ask, well, what about these other religions that say, hey, we are inclusive? I mean, typically Hinduism will tend to say that we're inclusive. Christ, Buddha, Krishna, Muhammad, they are all various incarnations. They're all manifestations of an eternal spirit. We are kind of inclusive and we are not exclusive. Now, I want you to think about that. Christians say Jesus is the only way. Another system says all ways is the only way. What's the difference? Christians say Jesus is the only way. Hinduism will say all ways is the only way. Everybody is saying theirs is the only way. Every truth claim is exclusive, and therefore all religions are exclusive. Now that's important to remember. When people tell us that, well, you guys are too exclusive, or we are more inclusive, don't get fooled into thinking that that's right. That's wrong. Because when somebody says, my way is the only way, they're exclusive. All right? So every truth claim is an exclusive truth claim. So if a religion claims to be true, whatever they believe, they are exclusive and they are not inclusive. And that's very important for us to remember. Because very often we're challenged. We say, they tell us that Christians are very exclusive people. They exclude everybody else. The fact is that every religious system is exclusive because everybody is saying they have the truth. And any truth claim is exclusive. It excludes everything that they think are false. Now, the fact that every truth claim is exclusive is very easy to kind of come up or bring up in a conversation. You press some hot button issue. Let's say you say something about abortion is wrong. If anybody argues with you, then that person is basically saying that he is right and I am wrong. And that person is saying he has the truth and I don't have the truth. So anytime you have an argument, arguments just prove that people believe that truth exists. So if anybody says truth doesn't exist, just start an argument with them. If they argue for a position, they're arguing because they expect me to believe what they say is true and to follow what they say is true. So truth is exclusive, and every religious system is exclusive. All religions are exclusive. Can religions be different pathways that lead to a mountaintop? In fact, a famous Indian philosopher suggested that all religions are like different trails that go up a mountain. And you can take any path, and finally you will get to the top. Think about it. How would you ever know that you can take any path and you'll get to the same destination. First of all, someone who has traveled each of these paths has to tell us the truth. That's one way. If somebody has taken every path, they come back to tell us that all these paths finally lead to the mountaintop. We can say, okay, every path is equally valid. Or we might have to, as I suggest in 3.2, travel each path to find out for ourselves. We go up each trail, and we know we finally reach the top of this mountain, then we can say every pathway leads to God. Another possibility is you can take a helicopter ride and go up on top of the mountain and see whether all these trails are coming up the mountain. If you can't do any of these, you just have to compare notes with people who travel on these paths and see whether they're describing the same destination. All right? And that's what we're going to do. Religions may be superficially the same, but fundamentally they are different. Now, all religions are basically trying to explain the puzzle of life. All religions are doing that. Where did I come from? Why am I here? What's the meaning and purpose to my life? Why is it that there is so much suffering? Why do good people suffer and bad people flourish? What is salvation? What happens after I die? Is life all over when I'm finally buried? These are the normal questions of existence that all of us have, and people all over the world have. So all these religious systems try to give answers to put all these pieces of the puzzle together and come up with a nice, coherent system. That's the goal of every religious system. And so the point there we have to recognize is, as one professor of religion said, if you make any religion look absolutely ludicrous, the chances are that you haven't understood it fully. Now, that's important for us to recognize. Religions are different ways of explaining reality. And all of us people all over the world experience the same struggles for the most part. We're all human. We all have the sinful nature. Certain conditions and circumstances may be different, but our experiences are shared and the same. So when people try to explain things, different religious systems try to explain the puzzle of life, there are elements of truth and reality in most of these religions. So to say that any system is absolutely ludicrous may suggest that we haven't fully understood it. Now, we can say this, though. We can take the answers that all these religious systems can give you, put it together, and see whether the puzzle fits or not. That much we can do. And then we can say, well, there is a hole here, there's a hole here, this does not fit. Therefore, it doesn't make sense. Okay? So as long as we remember that, we're okay. Now, you realize that while facts are all the same, interpretations are different. We all see the sun, we all see the stars, we all see the planetary bodies in all of its fine array. One person says, look at what God has created. Another says, look at the results of the Big Bang. It all depends on your basic assumptions. It's kind of like 4-year-old Mikey. He had a thumb-sucking problem, you know. He always used to suck his thumb. His parents tried all kinds of things. They threatened him, they bribed him. He just wouldn't let go. Finally, his mother had this brilliant flash of an idea, as only mothers can get, you know. One morning she woke up and she said, hey, Mikey, you know what? You suck your thumb. Your stomach's going to get big. And then you suck it further. It's just going to get big, big, bigger and bigger. And finally, it's going to burst. And that caught Mikey's attention. He was concerned. He stopped for a couple of days. In a few days, this family went to a party. And Mikey was next to a woman who was pregnant about 8 months and 15 days, you know. And so Mikey kind of looks at her, and then he looks at his mom. And then gears start clicking. Then he looks at her, and then he looks at his mom. He couldn't contain it anymore. Then he looks at this lady and says, I know what you've been up to. Now, Mikey interpreted facts. He did. based on what he knew. Okay? So as far as he was concerned, a big stomach implied thumb-sucking. Now, as humorous as it might seem, that is a fact of life. We interpret our experiences. We interpret all that we observe. We all see the same facts, but we come up with different interpretations depending on the lenses through which we view all these things. So if you wear rose-colored lenses, you're going to see everything rose-colored. If you wear blue-colored lenses, you're going to see everything blue-colored. All right? So what you will find is, as we go through, we'll see that fundamentally, all religions have a different idea of God. And once you hang your hat on a different idea of God, then all other interpretations flow from that. If you believe that God created, that he's personal, he's loving, he's gracious, and so on, then that implies a relationship, and a lot of other things flow out of that. If you believe that God is just an impersonal force out there, then certain other implications flow out of that. There is no idea of relationship, love, and so on. So fundamentally, the differences in all of these religions is their concept of God. And the moment we move away from the right concept of God, we are treading into this whole area of idolatry, which is why idolatry is such an important concept here in the Bible. It's not just worshiping some other gods. I mean, yes, that is blatant idolatry. But if we don't worship the God of the Bible as he has revealed himself in Jesus Christ, then we are committing idolatry. So it's very, very important to recognize the concept of God defines everything else in life. Or everything else. Your morality and explanation for all of life. So what I want to do is to basically go through this table here and to take a quick look at how different religions view different categories, those of God, of origin, of morality, condition, salvation, death, and destiny, and so on. And as we go through, you'll realize that the concept of God defines everything else in life. The concept of God defines everything else in life. Now, under Christianity there, I have a number of terms. Personal, triune, sovereign, just, merciful, gracious, and loving. Now, that is not an exhaustive list of God's attributes, obviously. I've just put down a few points there that describes our God. Now, those are all familiar territory, so I'm going to move on. In Islam, there is this idea of a personal God. In a sense, he is personal, but in a sense, he's not personal because he is so transcendent, he's so other that I really cannot even have a relationship with him. So when a Muslim says it's a personal God, yeah, he's a person, he's got an intellect and he's got a will and so on. But that's about where it ends because he's not a personal God in the way that we understand God, a personal God with whom we can have a loving relationship. That's not there. That's totally non-existent. God is one. God is one. We believe God is one, but he exists in three persons. And that's a fundamental difference there between Islam and our precious faith. God is sovereign, absolutely, totally powerful. God is just, justice at its extreme. Mercy, you got to put a question mark there because they will say Allah is merciful, but it is no concept of mercy that we understand. And you realize that a God who is one, who is absolutely just and sovereign, cannot really be gracious and loving because they don't believe in the Trinity. Now, how does that play out? You've got to ask yourself this question. Before God created, what was he doing with love? Who did he love? Did he need to create us so that he can express his love? Well, that's where we have a faith that's super duper. There is the Trinity. It tells that three persons were in community. There was this unity. There was this harmony. There was love within the three persons of the Godhead. And therefore, there is a basis for a God of love who can then love us. You don't have that in Islam. There is no Trinity. There is no basis for a God of love. So the concept of love and of grace is totally non-existent in the Islamic faith. Okay? So that's a basic difference. If you go into Hinduism, now you have a God who is impersonal, a God who is an eternal spirit. Now, if you ask some Hindus, they'll say God is personal. Some Hindus will say God is impersonal. Some will say God is a force. And depending on who you ask, it can be anything. But it is an eternal spirit, not readily knowable. You can't readily know this God. Now you got to ask the question, how do you know that he's not readily knowable? If you make a blanket statement that God is not knowable, I've got to tell you, well, at least you know that much, that he's not knowable. How do you do that? Well, there is no answer. And the other point that I want to make is, God, this eternal spirit, is one with creation. That means you and I are manifestations of God. And so are the trees and the animals and everything else. There is this one eternal spirit. It's kind of an ocean of a spirit that pops up as you, me, and everything else that you see. It's not God creating something and fashioning it with love and sovereignly guiding the affairs of men. No. God and the creation are one. Which is why you may not really pray to a God, but you look inward and meditate. Navel gazing, if you want to call it. Now, that is where you end up because that's the nature of God. You see where the problem is. Fundamentally, the difference is at God and his nature. Once you establish that, everything else flows from that. And that's what I want you to recognize. And then you have Buddhism, which doesn't even talk of God. Siddhartha Gautama, the founder, who became Buddha, he lived in a palace. He lived a very luxurious life, and he decided he wanted to see the world. He was sheltered from suffering. He went out. He saw a funeral procession. He saw some old people. He saw an old man dying, and so on and so forth. And he came up with this system. And his system is pretty straightforward, except that how it's workable is a question. You have four noble truths in Buddhism. The first noble truth is the existence of suffering. Birth is painful, death is painful, disease is painful, old age is painful. Not having what we desire is painful. Having what we do not desire is also painful. So that's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering. A craving desire for the pleasures of the senses, which seeks satisfaction now, here, and now there. The craving for happiness and prosperity in this life and in future lives. That is the cause of suffering. The third noble truth, the end of suffering. To be free of suffering, one must give up, get rid of, extinguish this very craving so that no passion and desire remain. That's the third noble truth. The fourth noble truth leads to the ending of all pain by way of the Eightfold Path. Now, what's the Eightfold Path? The first path is you've got to have the right views. You've got to accept the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That's the first path. The second path is you've got to have the right resolve. You've got to renounce pleasures, harbor no ills, and harm no one. Then you've got to have right speech. That's the third path. Do not lie, slander, or abuse, and no idle talk. I mean, these are all good in and of themselves. Don't you agree? It's great. Right behavior. Do not destroy any living creature. Take only what is given to you. Do not commit any unlawful sexual acts. Fifth path, right occupation. Earn your livelihood in a way that harms no one. Six, right effort. Resolve and strive heroically to prevent any evil qualities from arising in you and to abandon any evil qualities you might possess. Seven, right contemplation. Be observant, strenuous, alert, contemplative, free of desire and of sorrow. Eight, right meditation. When you have abandoned all sensuous pleasures, all evil qualities, both joy and sorrow, You must then enter into the 4 degrees of meditation which are produced by concentration. That's a quick summary of Buddhism. But the idea there is no idea of God. There are some truths. And fundamentally, Buddha was all about dealing with suffering. And he said this, in simple form, this is all it is. If you have no desires, you have no more suffering. Extinguish all desires, all passion, and you get rid of all of your suffering and struggles. Let's look at what these religions have to say about origin. Where did we come from? We believe that we are created, we are separate from the Creator. Islam also believes in creation, but it's not a God of love, so you cannot think in terms of creation being an act of love. In Hinduism, we're just a manifestation of God. We are one with the eternal spirit. Buddhism really doesn't have much to say about it because Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism. The founder of Buddhism, Siddhartha Gautama, was really a Hindu who went and answered the problem of suffering. So in terms of origin, again, you realize if you have a God who's a God of love and grace and who's sovereign, just and merciful, then he creates. It's an act of love. And this creation is separate from the Creator God. If you believe in an eternal spirit, then you and I are just manifestations of God. We're up today, gone tomorrow, in some other form, and so on. It depends on what you believe on God, about God. If we move on and look at morality, in the Christian faith, all our absolutes are rooted in the very nature of God. God is truth, and therefore speaking the truth is right. It's not because God dictated and said you should speak the truth. Our absolutes, what's right and wrong, are rooted in the very nature of God. God is love, and therefore love is right. God is truth, and therefore truth is right. God is merciful, and therefore it's right to be merciful. Our prescriptions are rooted in the nature of God. For the Muslim, his or her right and wrong is rooted in the text, in some words. Words in the Quran or in the Hadith, which is their traditions, or Sharia, which is Islamic law. But it's rooted in some text. And everything that's written was revealed, at least the Quran, what was written was revealed to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel, they believe. So it's rooted in the text, not in the nature of God. That makes a lot of difference. In Hinduism, of course, morality is just relative. It just depends. You kind of do the good thing and do what is right. And what is right can change. But if you talk to a Hindu, he'll say, well, you know, you pretty much know what's the right thing to do. You got to be kind to people and so on. And Buddhism, again, is relative. There are no absolutes. Again, if you don't believe in God, in whom all these are rooted, then you come up with all kinds of ideas for morality. Condition. Why are we in this present condition? We believe in the idea of original sin. We inherit our sinful natures, and that is responsible for all that we see around us. Islam, it's basically a very fatalistic religion. Kismet, the idea of fate for a Muslim, is total. It's purely fate and nothing else. He's totally at the mercy of God. Whatever God decides, that's it. He has absolutely nothing that he can do. It's a very fatalistic system. In Hinduism, of course, the condition that you're in is basically driven by karma, what you did. If you do some good today, you'll move up in this ladder of life. If you do something bad, in your next life, you're going to have more struggles and so on. It depends on good works, basically. Buddhism, the current condition, the problems, the struggles, the pain, it's all because of desire. If you can extinguish desire, you lose all of your problems and life becomes a breeze. salvation. I think that's very clear. We proclaim that it's through Christ. In Islam, salvation is obedience to a law, a fierce obedience to a law. In Hinduism, it's good works. You got to do good, and if you do good, you go up. In Buddhism, you've got to extinguish all desire. In Islam, actually, they believe that every person has two recording angels. One angel records what's good, and one angel records all your bad, and the final day of judgment, it's all presented, and judgments are made. So, salvation again, everything is different. You realize that it's because there is a difference in the concept of God. That's where the problem is. Destiny. Heaven or hell for Christianity. Heaven or hell for Islam. But their concept of heaven is a very carnal paradise. It's really not what we are talking about, which is why I have that in lowercase. They believe in hell, of course. Hinduism, there is reincarnation. The idea that there is transmigration of a soul. Depending on my life here, my soul can move into maybe the life of an animal or maybe another human being and so on. There is a recycling of the soul, if you will. So that's reincarnation. And in Buddhism, they really don't talk about it. In a sense, they're an offshoot of Hinduism, so many do believe in reincarnation. Well, that brings us then, of course, to the question, what is unique about Christ? He is the only way, we proclaim. What is unique about Christ? And I just have a few points there that I would like to touch on briefly. Obviously, this can be looked at from various angles, and you can make a case from many, many angles, be it very theoretical or experiential and so on. But I just want to touch on a few facts here. First of all, God's truth was communicated to us through Christ. And in there, I think primarily, we have an accurate description of human nature. It was Jesus who said, as it's recorded in Mark chapter 7, verses 20 through 23. And he was saying, that which proceeds out of the man, that is what defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. The problem, as the cliche goes, the problem with the human heart is really the heart of the human problem. I think it was Dwight L. Moody who was once asked why he thought that education was not the cure to the ills of the world. And he pointed to a few boys on a railroad track who were pulling nuts and bolts and stealing them. He said, you educate these guys, they'll steal the whole track. The problem is not one of education. The problem is one of a transformation of the human heart. The problem really is that we are wicked, and the problems are because of the wickedness and the evil in our own hearts, and not necessarily because of the environment that we were raised in. Yes, environments do play a part, friends do play a part, parents do play a part, upbringing plays a part. But fundamentally, our problem is the evil and the wickedness in our own hearts, which is what defile us, not what is outside. And Jesus rightly and accurately described that for us. We also have an explanation of God's law, and you can look at it in many ways, and I'd like to look at it this way. In Matthew chapter 7, Jesus gave what we commonly call the golden rule. I don't know whether it's a golden rule. He said, therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them, for this is the law and the prophets. Now, just think about it. If I want to be loved unconditionally, Jesus says, I've got to love unconditionally, right? If what Jesus said is true, that's what I have to do. Now, in my sinful self, I cannot do that. So right now, there is tension. Now, I got to resolve this. I want to be loved unconditionally, but I am sinful that I am not prepared to love unconditionally. The only way that tension can be resolved is if God changes my desires to want to love unconditionally. Only if I can love unconditionally, and that happens only when God transforms my heart, only then can I do something that I would like to be Only then can I love unconditionally and in turn be loved unconditionally. So he explained God's law to us, basically the law and the prophets all capsuled in one statement. If you think about it and unpack it, it's rather straightforward. It should lead us to this conclusion that we are sinful. We really cannot treat anyone else in and of ourselves. We cannot treat anyone else the way we would like to be treated. Yes, you can be kind and you can give a few dollars here and a few dollars there. But the heart of the matter is we really cannot treat somebody else in and of ourselves with the sinful and wicked hearts that we have. We cannot treat someone else the way we would like to be treated. And the only resolution there then becomes that God has to work in our lives. God's nature revealed, proof of his deity. Now, Jesus minced no words. He clearly said who he was. And although many people didn't like to hear that, he spoke the world into existence, the opening chapters of the Bible. He spoke people into discipleship. He spoke to heal people. He spoke to calm nature. He said he's going to die and he'll rise on the third day. And he triumphed over death. Everything about him proved his deity. And C.S. Lewis has said this, and I want to quote. "I am trying here to prevent," said Lewis, "anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse." It's pretty clear, one way or the other. Elsewhere, Lewis also says this. He says, "You can shut him up for a fool," talking about Jesus. "You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." He's not just some moral teacher. Either you dismiss him as a lunatic, or he is Lord and we fall down before him. The second is, he revealed God's nature of truth. Jesus said, "He who is of the truth hears my voice." And you know, he really gave us a test, didn't he? We know we are of the truth if we respond to what he says. When we read his word, if we have a response that wants to obey him, then we know that we are of the truth. If we don't want to obey him, either we are not of the truth or we are suppressing the truth. So God's nature was revealed, his truthful nature was revealed by Jesus. He also revealed godly living. He also revealed godly living. And the ultimate there was his prayer on the cross. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." It really models for us what godly living is like, revealing for us what God is like. Jesus he has no equal in human history. And then, of course, he showed justice and mercy at the cross. Now, think about it. If you start with the idea of God being just and also merciful, gracious, and loving, you've got to understand. You've got to wonder how does he do this? If God is just, he has to lash out punishment because he's got to be just. If he's got to be loving, then he can't punish me because he loves me. You have a dilemma, and it's resolved at the cross, and that's beautiful, because God's justice was satisfied when his Son, the second person of the Trinity, stretched out his arms and died and took our punishment on himself. So God's justice was satisfied, and thereby he could display his love and mercy and extend a gracious offer to us all. And that's the beauty of Christ. So he demonstrates justice and mercy on the cross. And of course, finally, God extends his grace. God extends his grace. First of all, there is transformation now. And this won't be long. In a few minutes, we'll close. The fundamental problem with all relationship is deceit and hatred. A lack of love and a lack of truth. A lack of love and a lack of truth. If you can take anybody and make that person loving and truthful, then you've solved the problems in relationships. Isn't that true? Think of a couple who's getting married. Let's say the groom stands there dressed like a penguin and he watches his bride walk in, dressed in radiant white, and they come. And let's say in the vows they make, they introduce the statement. Till death do us part, we'll be truthful to one another, but we are allowed to say one lie every year. Only one lie, and we don't have to tell each other when we lie. Okay? The wedding's over, they drive off into the sunset believing that they'll always have honey and never lose sight of the moon and so on, and they'll move. And he says, I love you. And she says, is that a lie? Is that the truth? She says she loves him. Is she lying or is she truthful? There can be no relationship if there is no truth. Every fractured relationship is fractured because of the lack of truth and the lack of love. And by love, I mean treating the other person as more important than yourself. So, if there is a lack of truth and a lack of love, you have fractured relationships among us and with us and God. So the solution to the problem, really, I mean, if you think in terms of a solution to problems, it's really taking the human heart that is untruthful and unloving and converting that and making it truthful and loving at any cost. And let me tell you, there is no system on this earth that can do that. There is absolutely no system in this world that can do that. Unless God's Spirit comes into your life and mine. Unless God's Spirit breathes life into us. And unless God's Spirit is able to live His life through us as we submit to His authority and lordship in obedience. There can be no transformation in lives and there can be no cure to human relationships and ills. So the transformation, because of the Spirit of God coming and residing in us, is the solution to a human problem. And God extends that grace to us. We don't have to live with deceit and untruthfulness. We can be converted. We can be transformed because of the power of the Holy Spirit who resides in us if we choose to invite Him. And then, of course, God's grace. He gives us sustaining grace. He doesn't promise us a life that's free of struggles, but He promises to be with us in and through those struggles, which is why Annie Johnson Flint, suffering from rheumatoid arthritis, could write, He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater, and so on. And we have numerous stories that could be repeated, and I'm sure in an audience of this size, we'll all have stories to say about God's sustaining grace through times of struggle. So God extends His grace. And last, of course, there is life forever that God provides to us, which Christ alone can give. So what does all this mean for us? I think there is another fundamental idea that we got to remember, and that is that truth and love are not mutually exclusive. Truth and love are not mutually exclusive. If I present the truth to anybody, if it is not presented with love, perfect love, where that other person recognizes that I'm truly interested in that other person, that I care for that other person, there can be no impact because the truth is rather obnoxious to somebody who is being challenged or confronted with it. So truth and love are not mutually exclusive. Truth has to go hand in hand with love. So I want to close this evening with this plea. If there is anybody here, if there's anybody here who has not experienced this transforming work of the Holy Spirit, God's transforming work in your life that can convert a heart of deceit and hatred into a heart of love and truth, I would plead with you that you resolve that, you address that today. If you want to be here and speak to somebody, I'm sure there'll be many people willing to interact with you. If you don't feel like doing that, go home, fall on your knees, cry out to God that He may extend His grace and you may be empowered and you may have the life both now and in the hereafter, eternal life. So, in sharp contrast to all of our ways and all of the multiple pathways out in the marketplace, God invites us to fall in love with Him. And He has made this possible through His Son, Jesus Christ, who is indeed the way, the truth, and the life.